Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, America the Unprepared Again. After 9/11, the federal government vowed it would make sure the country was better prepared to respond to the next calamity, the next terrorist attack. It created the Department of Homeland Security, put a color-coded alert system into place, made big promises to states to help fund local emergency preparedness efforts. Then along came Katrina. This time, the attacker was Mother Nature, not Al-Qaeda, and she came with plenty of warning. And the post-9/11 response, excruciatingly clumsy, slow, and in the president's own words, not acceptable. And that is getting the attention of the nation's top terror analysts. This hour, On Point, national security and what the Katrina response tells us about the country's ability to deal with terrorism. You can join the conversation. Have you looked at Katrina and wondered what if this had been a terror attack? If this was a test of post-9/11 readiness, how did we do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We begin in Washington with Brian Bennett. He covers national security and terrorism for Time magazine. He's former Baghdad bureau chief for Time. He just returned yesterday from New Orleans and is headed back to the Gulf Coast later today. Brian Bennett, thanks for being with us.
Good to be on the show.
New Orleans brought Baghdad to mind for you and others. Why?
Well, on the very surface, just flying into an area that really had the devastation and feeling of a war zone in my own country. I was flying in with a group of Air Force Reserve rescue men who are highly trained unit, trained to go behind enemy lines and pluck down pilots under fire and bring them out and give them medical attention. This is a unit that I had been with in Iraq, spent some time with as an embedded reporter, and here I was in the same type of helicopter flying in on same mission to save life, but unfortunately in one of our own cities.
You say the scene below looked like a war zone, houses blown to splinters, cars abandoned on the roads, crowds of huddled refugees, the smell of war, diesel fuel and the fetid smells coming up from New Orleans. But what you really point to is the Air Reservist frustration with the lack of coordination there. You quote Colonel Timothy Tarchuk saying, "It's absolute chaos," screaming into his satellite phone over the thump of the helicopter, saying, "I've got women separated from their children. We have no medicine. We need security. It's like freaking Baghdad here." Why?
Well, let me tell you the context of those remarks. Colonel Tarchuk, he's the commander of the 920th Rescue Wing out of Patrick Air Force Base. He has, in the area right now in around New Orleans, he has seven rescue helicopters under his command, and there are many other assets like that in the area. He had gone down into the area. The helicopter that he was in was shuttling people from the roofs of their houses and bridges in New Orleans to layup areas, places where they could be on dry land,
right.
Hopefully get some medical attention. And this one layup area where they were brought to at Lakefront Airport, it turned out was not a designated recovery spot. And there were a few very tired and noble firemen who worked there at the airport who were trying to take care of 1,000 displaced survivors who had shown up there on their landing strip, and they were running out of water. They had run out of food. They had one porta potty for 1,000 people,
and they were being more refugees or evacuees were being taken there by the Army, the Air Force Reserve, even though it wasn't designated as a place. There weren't facilities there for them. You quote Colonel Tarchuk saying, "Who's running things? Nobody, as far as I can tell."
Frustrated the pilots themselves because they only found out after someone got out of the helicopter on the ground to find out that this place was woefully understaffed and undersupplied, and it was a security hazard for the rescue men and the people there, and most importantly a security hazard for the survivors. And Colonel Tarchuk was talking at the chain of command, trying to find somebody he could tell to shut off the flow of people incoming to this position, but he was having trouble figuring out who was in charge and who could tell all the rescue helicopters in the region, and there should have been one dispatcher in charge of doing that, who could tell them all to stop bringing people to this place.
Brian Bennett, you cover national security, terrorism, homeland security. Is there reason to think that this response was somehow different or worse than a response might be if instead of a hurricane, this had been a terrorist attack? What if terrorists had blown those levees, or if it was a biological attack on New Orleans? Are there alternate communication systems that would have kicked in if this were actually a terror attack instead of a storm?
Well, I'll tell you, since September 11th, the United States has beefed up its number of operation centers that are watching reports about terrorist attacks and coordinating response between the agencies across the government. We have the NCTC, the National Counterterrorism Center. These are rooms where 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there are people from all the agencies watching reports and ready to deploy in response. And FEMA plays that role for natural disasters, but because FEMA has been knocked down in the hierarchy of the administration, it's according to people I've spoken with, involved in the rescue effort, there was just too many sort of bureaucratic hurdles that they had to jump through between getting permissions from the military to use their assets, and it took too long to get a response. Colonel Tarchik, the wing commander who's running those some of those helicopters going down into New Orleans to bring people out, he said he was ready to deploy and told FEMA and told his commanders at NORTHCOM he was ready to send his helicopters at 6 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning, and he didn't hear word back permission to go until Tuesday at 4:20 in the afternoon, which was 34 hours later.
And meanwhile, on the ground in New Orleans, in Louisiana, where $750 million has been funneled for Homeland Security since 9/11, security forces could not speak to themselves. The same problem that emerged in New York on September 11, 2001, where communications went down. We saw the problems that emerged, and you're left with a veteran of the Iraq War saying New Orleans looks like Baghdad, wondering who runs things. Brian Bennett with Time Magazine, thank you very much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Brian Bennett covers national security and terrorism for Time. He just came out of New Orleans, and he's headed right back there. He joined us from Washington. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Juliet Kayyem, a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, a former member of the National Commission on Terrorism. Juliet Kayyem, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
There's an allusion there in Brian's remarks to a system monitoring for terror and readiness for terror. Is there some kind of great alternate system that wasn't deployed this time, or is what you see what you get? If this had been a terror attack, would we be looking at the same disarray?
Yes, more likely than not. It's not like there's some alternative system of personnel and security people and first responders that come out of the woodwork if this had been terrorism. So for the most part, what we see was what we got. I think there would probably have been some differences if this had been terrorism, both for good and for bad. I mean, for one is I think that the military response starting on Sunday was just was abysmal, was completely, it's unexplainable at this time.
And you mean a week ago Sunday?
Yes, excuse me. Mm-hmm. That's right, a week ago Sunday. And whether that's because the military, we still don't have a good system of involving the military in just a complete civilian breakdown, tragedy, that's not war. And so the question will be, I think, in the after-action reports is sort of, you know, we were able to galvanize the military in all sorts of ways abroad. Why can't we do that for something that's clearly not war, but looks, as Brian just said, looks a lot like war?
Well, let me ask you about that point in particular, because, of course, Americans have historically not been eager to get the formal military involved on the domestic scene. But we've seen this tremendous struggle here, apparently, between Louisiana and New Orleans and the federal government about who was in charge. Governor Blanco not wanting to sign over control of her National Guard to the feds.
Right.
The feds not getting the army in there quicker. If it had been terror, does all that go away? Are the gates down? The army comes straight in?
I don't think that the gates are down. No, there would still be sort of the National Guard would still have to be federalized. I just think all of that would have happened quicker because I think in our mind, the way that we conceive of what war and the military are, it would have been, oh, terrorism, this clearly fits the bill. But one thing about that I have to say, you know, The governor is getting a lot of criticism, at least from the administration. Like, why didn't she call the military sooner? The truth is she did call a state of emergency in late August. And what we have to know is that the federal response plan that Chertoff designed that came out earlier in 2004 says, basically, the feds no longer have to wait, that we have to be proactive. If we see a city crumbling, we no longer, I mean, the governor could be dead. The mayor could be dead. We don't have to wait for these people. And so one of the questions I have is, even if you could put up every legal or bureaucratic reason for why the system didn't work, why wasn't someone in Washington, and this was, you know, obviously all of us have a level of anger and frustration having looked back at the last 8 days, why wasn't that proactive system put into place? And I think that's something that DHS, whatever excuses they may have at this stage, is going to have to explain, given that their own federal response plan says, I mean, look, if there had been a nuclear attack in New Orleans, no, we know that the mayor and the governor might not have been able to call if they had been there.
Sure.
So that's
not to mention that you wouldn't have had 80% of the city evacuated instead of dealing with
the
remainder.
And I mean, here's another difference when I think through sort of, you know, what do we have to learn? One, I think we're incredibly good as a nation on the sort of, you know, one instant moment of devastation that we saw on September 11th. I mean, no one was expecting that, and yet we did pretty well, although, of course, we know that we lost numbers of, you know, this was the first test of sort of the sustained emergency management. And we're not training for that. We're not putting our money or resources into that. And we knew that this was a hurricane. I mean, in a terrorism incident, if you think of a biological attack, it may be weeks before we even know what it is.
We wouldn't even know what was going on. This came in a wide open fashion across the Gulf of Mexico. Juliet Kyan, please stand by. We're talking this hour about national security and what the Katrina response tells us about American readiness. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are talking about national security and what the Katrina response tells us about the country's readiness to deal with terrorism. You can join the conversation. Have you looked at Katrina and wondered to yourself, what if this had been a terror attack? What if there had been zero warning? What if no one had been evacuated from New Orleans before the blow? Are you confident that the U.S. government is better prepared for a terror attack than it apparently was for Hurricane Katrina? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined from Cambridge, Massachusetts, in this hour by Juliet Kyan, a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School, former member of the National Commission on Terrorism, co-editor of First to Arrive, State and Local Response to Terrorism, and right now from Old Lyme, Connecticut, by Stephen Flynn, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, former commander in the U.S. Coast Guard, served as project director for the Homeland Security Task Force that was co-chaired by Senators Gary Hart and Warren Rudman. He's author of America the Vulnerable. Stephen Flynn, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
So help us here. You've got a lot of experience, as does Juliet, in this area. As American citizens, watching what has happened in the past week after a natural disaster, what should we be thinking about the country's readiness for a significant terror attack?
Well, Americans obviously should be extremely skeptical about the assurances that they've been receiving that everything that can be done has been done to deal with a catastrophic event on U.S. soil, whether it's man-made or result of a natural disaster. And frankly, they should be a little bit ashamed about just where we are at.
We've heard the blame game coming out of Washington and other state and local offices in the last 24 hours, Stephen Flynn. What about the finger pointing? Is it justified? I mean, we'd like to think that we're beyond that, that that's exactly the kind of thing that's been sorted out, so we're not vulnerable to confusion over who's in charge.
Well, thousands of our most desperate members of our population, the poorest and the ill, elderly, and so forth, have perished unnecessarily in the last week. So the need for accountability is a central part of our democracy. And also, I would argue that since another event could happen relatively quickly, whether it's terrorists or another hurricane that rolls up the coast, we need to very quickly assess what went wrong and why it went wrong and get on to fixing these things. But it should not come as a surprise to most of observers that, in fact, the government, the federal government, and state and local players perform so poorly.
Why should it not be a surprise? I mean, we've had all these years since 9/11. We thought we were spending a lot of money and putting the serious focus of the country into bracing up just that kind of capacity.
Well, it's really not where we've put the serious focus of our country. For the last few years, we've been basically doing the away game. We've heard time and again from Washington that we do it over there so we don't have to do it here. We invest $500 billion a year on traditional national security, supposed to keep problems at arm's length. What's happened here is that the central, I would argue, that the central sort of design of the system, which is that states and locals must bear the bulk of the responsibility for managing attacks on the soils, and the federal government will come in, a la the Department of Homeland Security, as sort of a plug-and-play backfill. Mm-hmm. It's only as strong as the state and local capabilities, and I guess why I say people shouldn't be surprised is anybody who's been looking at the funding capabilities and the situation on the ground with regard to emergency planning, with first responder capabilities in any of our major cities, particularly the poorest ones like New Orleans, knows that they basically have not been ready for prime time for dealing with this. But as long as the federal government basically said, hey, that's a state and local responsibility, and our job is just to get our act together here in Washington to plug and play, what we saw very clearly is that DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, couldn't maintain any situational awareness of what was going on precisely because things broke down at the state and local level. But there's another core problem. The Department of Defense has largely isolated itself from this whole issue of Homeland Security. They've even come up with the term that their job is Homeland Defense, that is protecting things that come from, when it comes from outside the United States. And the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, early on when the department was created, created a line, basically said that if the Department of Homeland Security wants anything, if they want an analyst or a helicopter ride, I must personally sign off on the release. Because essentially centralized control out of a concern that the Department of Homeland Security would be a drain on DOD resources. So, in fact, we didn't have this robust capability. Something of this scale, as we've seen very clearly in the last few days, requires, because simply the Department of Homeland Security hasn't been toured to a point where it can play this role effectively, that it required troops on the ground and our national security assets. But our national security assets were three removed. First, it was state and locals that would have to make the case to the Department of Homeland Security. They then, in turn, would have to say help to DOD, and that broke down in the first 72 hours.
Juliet Kayyem, nobody wants to be rolled over by the federal government, but everyone wants to be helped. We see this report in the Chicago Tribune that offshore from New Orleans, you had the USS Bataan equipped with operating rooms, hundreds of hospital beds, ability to produce 100,000 gallons of fresh water a day, sitting off the Gulf Coast since last Monday without patients. And meanwhile, you've got Governor Blanco's spokesperson in Louisiana saying, we wanted soldiers, helicopters, food, and water. They, that is Washington, wanted to negotiate an organizational chart. So do we have something wrong with the essential game plan here?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's right. I mean, I think local and states, just something like this, would not have the capacity to deal with the mass debilitation of an entire city. And that should... To me, that should not be a surprise. Like that, I mean, that we knew, and in terms of the sort of planning that people thought about what are the worst catastrophes out there, this was one of the top three. This was, if the levees broke, New Orleans would be eviscerated.
So if we knew, why the failure to step up and address what would be required?
Well, I think part of it is what Steve said about this traditional... the military hides behind the law and says, oh, we're not allowed to do this stuff, or, you know, their history, they don't like doing this stuff. And so part of it is just sort of the tradition of the military to not really step up to the plate and sort of say, you know, we're going to make this as easy as possible.
But we thought that 9/11 was supposed to blow out the cobwebs.
Right, exactly.
And you're telling me that that's not happened.
I mean, surprise for a number of reasons. One is the Department of Homeland Security put... You know, minimize the role of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. FEMA couldn't, let alone the fact, and I want to make this clear, FEMA had been sort of demoted well before September 11th, just with the sort of person, I mean, I think the people who were leading it under this administration were more political appointees, Joe Albaugh, than professionals.
But on the flow chart, it had more status than it had after.
It had more status, and it never could compete. I mean, if you think of it sort of psychologically, it never could compete with war, right? That hurricanes and earthquakes were never going to galvanize the American public, let alone Congress, in the way that war certainly has in the last 3.5 years.
Yeah, but I have to ask you about that, because terror is something in between natural disaster and war,
right,
isn't it? I mean, terror could produce the kind of scenes we've seen in New Orleans. So how could that split, that bifurcation remain once we know that?
It's inexcusable. I mean, I think we all saw it. I mean, it was visual. I mean, look at one way that's been roundly criticized: the funding mechanism for how states and localities were getting money from DHS. For the most part, it was irrational based on both where catastrophes could befall us, and secondly, where terrorism was likely to strike, so that states like Montana were getting $40 per person, where a state like mine and yours, people were, you know, the federal government was giving us $11 to protect people. I mean, it made no sense rationally. So the system has never worked, and guess what? It was exposed in this just horrific series, you know, week and a half that we've been looking at.
Yeah.
And the question is, you know, are we going to just go through this cycle again after Hurricane Katrina, where we all sort of say, now we've really got to fix it, and it doesn't get fixed.
See,
I mean, the idea that DHS fixed it, I think, was a myth from the beginning.
But that is not a very satisfying thing to be told. I mean, you guys work in this, and you may know it. You may be jaundiced. I don't think most Americans are or want to be. Stephen Flynn, Michael Chertoff, the head of the Department of Homeland Security, seems to be drawing distinctions between what happened here and what might happen in a terror attack, what the response might be in a terror attack. He's saying, you know, this is overwhelming, this is nature. But on the other hand, as we thought about it here, if it were a terror attack, you would not have that warning. You might well have multiple targets dispersed around the country, as we had on 9/11. And you wouldn't have just looters or, you know, a criminal element, but serious attackers even post the attack intent on doing more damage. Would a terror attack necessarily be less menacing than even Hurricane Katrina?
Well, first, I'd say to Secretary Chertoff's credit, when he came in, he made preparedness a priority precisely because he acknowledged that we don't have a foolproof system. And frankly, for about the first 3 years, the department was almost at blind to saying, well, our job has to be preventing things, and we can't even imagine the unimaginable.
Oh.
And basically he said that's prior. That being said, obviously, in the last few months, not a whole lot could change, given that this is systemic issues. And at the top of the government, there wasn't much support for preparedness. Now, I think you're absolutely right, Tom. I mean, the reality is this was a flood that was predictable and which we had warning and which we evacuated most of the city. The problems were things like distributing food and water to the emergency gathering centers.
Mm-hmm.
It was about getting people out who were poor and elderly and evacuating hospitals with advance notice. These are all things that are manageable. It's not something we ask everyday citizens to worry about, is to think about disaster, but that's why they have a government at the state, local, and federal level.
But in a terror attack, you wouldn't have had 20% of New Orleans' population. You would hypothetically have had all of it sitting in there.
But this is, on 9/11, as somebody worried about these issues in advance of that dreadful day, I remember recalling and saying time and again here that Lower Manhattan is the only place in this country where the government could look competent
because
basically it was one area where there was reasonable redundancy and capabilities, that if this had happened in any other major city, we would have the twin horror of the terrorist event and gross government incompetence in responding. In this case, we have a natural disaster where you know, the ocean, I was actually in Asia at the time, but when I saw people on Sunday evening being ushered into the convention center, I knew that the levees couldn't stand above a Category 3, and they were saying a Category 4 or 5 dead
right,
on here.
Right.
And I'm just going, this is nuts. But it's not, and I'm not somebody who's immersed myself in New Orleans, but I know enough about the critical infrastructure and issues there. So, but this, again, is a breakdown in this sort of situational awareness. There's so much rhetoric and so little reality in terms of taking this on. And recognizing that this really is a, you know, almost decades in the making series of problems.
Yeah, but so much rhetoric and so little reality, and that just does not seem acceptable going on 4 years nearly now after 9/11. Stephen Flynn, Juliet Kayyem, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're looking at national security and what the Katrina response has shown us about the country's readiness to deal potentially with terrorism. Hal is calling from Richfield, Connecticut. Hi, Hal. You're on the air.
What I'm concerned about is after the Department of Homeland Security said this was the number three threat, hurricane in New Orleans.
Right.
Why didn't someone up in the administration say, well, we need to build these levels up higher of the levees, you know?
Of course, that was said but not funded. So what do you take from that, Hal?
I take that it's not very intelligent, basically, you know, just to say it real straight. It's not hard to see the danger. And if you're going to have a Department of Homeland Security at all, and if they're going to make a list of here's the threats, then the administration should take responsibility and say, here's what we did to address, say, these top 10 threats.
That would make sense. Stephen Flynn is saying this morning that what was done instead was the away game, the emphasis put on fighting terrorism over there so we don't have to fight it over here. You know, every government has to have priorities. Is that a legitimate priority to you, Hal?
Well, it's exactly that they prioritized and said it was number three on this long list, you know. That's why it bothers me that the levee projects that they even requested, by the way, were underfunded.
Yeah, and underfunded by tens of millions. Hal, thank you for your call. Let's get another call here.
Tom, if I can just add real briefly,
yes,
a briefing in Memphis with the Army Corps engineers on the state of basically maintaining dams and lock system in the inland waterway, which is just vital to the lifeblood of our country.
Mm-hmm.
And they were lamenting that they had a $1 billion shortfall in the routine maintenance funds they need to keep the system going. And this is a case where they said,
who needs terrorists?
$1 trillion infrastructure, and yet we were a $1 billion shortfall. And the Washington was, just pick your top five projects. And then the pushback was, look, it is this $1 trillion shortfall or infrastructure that people gave life and limb to build.
Mm-hmm.
Picking which part of it we'll maintain doesn't make any sense. And the pushback was, well, what's wrong with a system where you pick the five best horses and say you're going to back those? And the response was, as I thought quite accurately, was, that's fine, but don't kill the rest of the field.
This is not a horse race. This is American life with Americans living there. I want to get a call from Alexandria, Virginia. Ellen is calling. Hi, Ellen. You're on the air.
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity. I think I'm just going to echo a lot of what your guests have said. Homeland security is just that. It's security of the homeland. The strategies we're going to use for a terrorist attack should be very different than what we're using for a natural disaster.
Are you confident that they are, that the capacity is different, Ellen?
No, I don't think we've... I'm thinking, is San Francisco putting in place today strategies to evacuate folks if the big one happens? We all sort of turn our backs to it and say, well, yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. But that New Orleans should have been evacuated before, not after the power was lost, not when the waters came rushing in.
Well, they tried. They put out the word. A lot of people did get out, and still, here's what we see. Do you think it would be different if this had been a terror attack, Ellen?
No, I think it would be worse. But what we didn't do is we didn't give the poor and the vulnerable the tools to get out. They said, get out. But they didn't say, here are the city buses, pack a bag, we'll bus you up to Raleigh, and when the thing is over, we'll bring you back.
Yep, there's the piece that wasn't there. Ellen in Alexandria, thanks for calling. Our time is short before the break. Juliet Kayyem.
Just quickly, I'm missing on Ellen's point. Look, New Orleans had two major drills, one in 2000 and 2004, emergency management drills. Both of them were incredibly successful. And none of them dealt with the catastrophe that everyone knew was going to happen, which was that the levees would break. Why you would spend so much time drilling for not the worst-case scenario, I think, is both a bureaucratic difficulties and also something psychological about why wouldn't you drill for the possibility that 80% of your population could get out? What are you going to do with that 20%?
We've just got a minute before the break. Let me ask you, and this may be a silly question, but could those levees have been ruptured with, I don't know, a few pickup trucks full of ammonium nitrate and some dynamite? Could they have been blown by terrorists? Is that a silly question?
No, I think the suspicion is yes.
I don't mean that they were this time. I don't even suspect right. that. But that if someone had wanted to flood New Orleans deliberately in an act of terror, you're saying, yes, that could have been done.
Right. I think that that was also always one of the concerns. I mean, Steve Flynn has spent a lot of time on sort of brilliant assessments of our port insecurity as well. But I think that the levees are equally vulnerable. I'm not sure how, I mean, I'm not an expert in.
But it's
how
not
you
a hypothetical
them,
question.
Certainly on the list. Mm.
Juliet Kayyem, Stephen Flynn, please stand by. We're talking about national security and what the Katrina response tells us about the country's readiness to deal with terrorism. You can join the conversation. If this was a test of post 9/11 readiness, how did we do? And has it made you rethink your family's own evacuation plan? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about national security and what the Katrina response tells us about the country's readiness to deal with terrorism. You can join the show. What do you think? Could a would-be terrorist, what could he or she learn about the United States from last week's chaos? And do you think we have some kind of mighty organization that we've just kept hidden during the last week? Could we do better if the cause were terror? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined in this hour by Juliet Kayyem, a lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, former member of the National Commission on Terrorism. Stephen Flynn is with us. He is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, former commander in the U.S. Coast Guard, worked with Gary Hart and Warren Rudman on their big Homeland Security Report, author of America the Vulnerable, How Our Government is Failing to Protect Us from Terrorism. And right now from Arlington, Virginia, we're joined by Roger Cressy. He's president of Good Harbor Consulting, advises clients on homeland security, counterterrorism. He held high positions in counterterrorism under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, was involved in the U.S. response to the Millennium Terror Alert, the USS Cole attack, the September 11th attack. Roger Cressy, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Tom.
All right, just give us your top assessment here. What should we, could we as citizens learn about our readiness for terror from what we've seen in the Katrina case?
Well, the past week, the events of the past week, I'm struck by one of the conclusions from the 9/11 Commission report, which was there was a failure of imagination on the part of government. And I think you've seen part of that over the past week as well. The Department of Homeland Security just was not thinking creatively about contingency planning for what would have happened had the levees broke. And maybe people thought because the hurricane tacked to the east that there wasn't going to be as great of a problem. I don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions right now on the federal response. Now, the second point would be we need to learn more about what was going on at the state and local level. Decisions were made that in the early days leading up to the hurricane's impact and immediately afterwards, those decisions had consequence.
What kind of decisions?
Well, I think it's a question of how quickly resources from around not just Louisiana but from surrounding states were brought into the picture. And this is a function of the federal response. And it's also, frankly, a question of what the governor's office did and when did they do it. And we're getting competing stories right now.
Are you saying that they were slow in Louisiana in putting up the flag saying send the help?
What I'm saying is that there's blame to go around at every level here. And as bad as the Department of Homeland Security has been in their initial response, this was a question of failures at the vertical. By that I mean at the state, local, and federal level. So I'd be careful about pinning blame exclusively on one level of government right now.
But certainly there's a coordination issue here that is front and center. Roger Cressy at Good Harbor Consulting, thanks very much for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
I want to turn to a caller. Brian's calling from Fort Meade, Maryland. Hi, Brian. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Good
and happy Labor Day to all.
To all.
Our thoughts certainly go out to those in need most, and we certainly offer our prayers and thoughts for them. What occurs to me, though, is the primary issues that this situation raises. We all understand that that there was a need for personnel. My question, I've got 2 points to make, really. The National Guard, their primary purpose, I always understood it to be available for state use, and then in emergencies, then for homeland defense. But we know that they're being deployed and used outside the country.
Heavily. And your second point, Brian?
Second point is the basic things. There's always an 80-20 rule. We always have to plan to exploit 80% of our public funds for 20% of the problem. In other words, if there's a 20% poor population, that's who we need to concentrate the money on and so forth. The real issue that I see in this whole mess is that a basic thing, communication. Communication was not there. Without communication, nothing else can happen. And the forces from FEMA or whomever is brought in has to set up a communication network so that the rest of the thing can function.
Sounds good, but it didn't function here. We heard Senator Landrieu of Louisiana saying exactly that, that she was frustrated with the failure of communication. Brian, thanks for your call. Stephen Flynn, what about the National Guard deployment to Iraq here? Is that a big problem? Can you feel the effect of that?
Well, I'm sure we did. I mean, it's very important that one of the reasons why we want to have capability at the local state level and we rely on National Guard units is there's no substitute for local knowledge. People sort of walk the streets, pound the pavement, know the players, especially in crisis. And so just parachuting people in from the outside, while as capable as they are, every new environment is alien, particularly in a crisis. So there's no question, of course, some of those people, a good portion of those folks were away. And some of that capability to prepare for these disasters has been weakened because of the need to deal with the national security imperative and isolated from this.
That's an interesting point you're making, that it's not just having National Guard at large available, but ideally the state's own National Guard, who are most likely to understand that state's highways and byways and people.
And for even further, many of the people who are in our National Guards come from our police departments, come from our fire departments, come from our emergency medical technicians and so forth. The people who, so to some extent, you've had a weakening of the leadership, especially within the local level here, to support the National Guard's mission. Now, this has been well documented for a while. That the challenge here is, again, that the assumption in Washington was that that's a state and local problem to resolve or backfill. The federal government's job is to take care of national security beyond our shores. And we just simply have not had a debate in our country about whether or not this is appropriate division of labor, given the likelihood of the kind of scale disasters that we saw play out here in a hurricane, which may be man-made as well.
Juliet, let me ask you on that. The federal government has said it is not a problem that we have so many National Guard to deploy in Iraq. Look, we're flooding Louisiana belatedly, but nevertheless with National Guard. Is it an issue or not?
I think it's hard to tell right now. I don't see how it couldn't be an issue given the stress on the National Guard that we've been hearing about for the last 2 years with the war in Iraq, that both in terms of the size and the capability of our National Guard, where they're deployed, and then sort of who in fact is in Iraq versus who stayed here, where's the equipment, where are the resources. And as Steve Flynn pointed out, the point, what we call the two-hat syndrome, which is, right, I mean, most of the men and women who a lot of the men and women who join the National Guard are also our first responders, that they are, you know, the cop is also going to then be deployed to Iraq. And to the extent that that may have hurt not just New Orleans but surrounding areas, I think we're going to have to find out. I don't know the numbers right now, but it seems hard to be able to separate the debate we've been having about the National Guard the last 2 years from what happened the last, 10 days. And I want to bring up something else Steve Flynn brought up, which I think is really important, and it's about the debate we're going to have as a country, hopefully that we're going to have as a country, which is there are bad things, and then there are really, really bad things. And I think Secretary Chertoff, prior to this last 10 days, was very good about trying to communicate to the American public that we cannot
give Americans 100% security. And what we need to do is to prioritize.
Right.
Why New Orleans was not a priority, we may know or we'll find out eventually. But we as a country cannot demand of our political leaders, you know, foolproof security, foolproof emergency plans. Like a hurricane
of course.
Florida is bad. A hurricane that destroys the levees in New Orleans and floods it is biblically bad. And we have to, you know, it's...
No one's saying we don't want more hurricanes.
We have to make these decisions.
Yeah, but no one is saying we should be exempt from nature, from hurricanes. I mean, Americans even accept that we may be hit by terrorism, that terrorists can get through our defenses. But there is an expectation that the response on the other side of a foreseeable attack or disaster should be competent. Is that too much to ask?
That is not too much to ask, but I do think that when we talk about limited resources, which we're clearly talking about, and we're talking about where is the money going to be spent, I mean, Chertoff got into a lot of trouble after the London subway bombings. I thought he was absolutely right when he said, look, you know, a bunch of suicide bombers on trains is bad. No one's denying that.
Right.
A nuclear backpack is catastrophic. And if we're going to talk about prioritizing these things, we've got to be able to start talking about where are the resources and efforts going to be spent. I think
are you apologizing in a way then for Chertoff saying, look, New Orleans was bad, but this isn't their top priority?
No. I'm saying I don't understand. I'm saying the national discussion that we're going to have after, I think, has got to be able to have a way to prioritize, which should have prioritized things like New Orleans, which everyone knew was going to be one of the top three disasters. Instead of giving $40, you know, I'm going to move to Billings, Montana. I mean, instead of doing this silly thing where, you know, we're going to give money to everyone.
You mean new fire trucks?
It's ridiculous.
I hear that. I hear it. Juliet, our time is short. I want to turn to you, Stephen Flynn, just for a minute more about what lessons, if any, and I hate to think this way, but that, I mean, we are being watched. The potential terrorists are out there. Are they laughing at this? Are they refining their plans? Does this open up for the world to see more new American vulnerabilities?
The biggest worry that I've had is not what terrorists can do to us, it's what we can do to ourselves when we're unprepared. That is the cascading effects that come from these events. The reason why our enemies would engage in catastrophic terror as a means of warfare is because their aspiration would be that they could get a big bang for their buck.
Sure.
So the extent to which it's clear that the government remains very unorganized at the local level, that you can hit a major city and the response will be will lead to not only huge loss of life. The other shoe that has not yet dropped yet, of course, is all the critical infrastructure that's in the New Orleans area. When we talk about prioritizing, it is our
oil and gas and transshipment.
Yep. Yes, gas and so forth. Not at all to diminish, of course, the life and limb issues. Mm-hmm. But we have still a whole series of things that we are very poorly prepared to respond to. Some efforts being made that's basically below the radar for most folks, but it could really have a bite for all of us.
Juliet, we've just got half a minute here. Do you think, and I don't want to sound paranoid here, but do we, in a sense, invite terrorism by not showing a more competent response to a challenge like Katrina? We've just got half a minute, but what do you think?
Is the extent to which we are prepared and more resilient as a society, we can deter this kind of thing, and we get an added benefit. We can cope with natural disasters like we saw in Katrina as well.
I'm sure we'll hear an amen to that, Juliet Kayyem.
Absolutely.
And with that, we're out of time, but we're very grateful to both of you. Juliet Kayyem, co-editor of First to Arrive, lecturer at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, a former member of the National Commission on Terrorism. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Stephen Flynn, author of America, the Vulnerable, former commander in the U.S. Coast Guard, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Mr. Flynn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums there. In a moment, President Bush taps John Roberts for the top job on the Supreme Court. This is On Point. John Roberts doesn't even have the job, and he's already being tapped for a promotion. Today, President Bush picked Roberts to succeed William Rehnquist as Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. The announcement comes the day before confirmation hearings were scheduled to begin on Roberts' qualifications to be just one of seven. With the nominee, or not, I should say, with the nominee by his side this morning in the Oval Office, President Bush praised Roberts as a man of integrity and fairness. He also said he expected the Senate to move swiftly on his confirmation.
The Senate is well along in the process of considering Judge Roberts' qualifications. They know his record and his fidelity to the law. I'm confident that the Senate can complete hearings and confirm him as Chief Justice within a month.
Joining me now for analysis is Tony Morrow, Supreme Court reporter for the Legal Times. Tony, thanks for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
What is the response in Washington to the news that that John Roberts will be nominated not just to be one of nine, but the Chief Justice?
Well, I think it was kind of a surprise. I mean, the Chief Justice hasn't even been buried yet, and now we have an appointment to replace him. But if you think about it, maybe it wasn't a surprise because John Roberts was first interviewed by President Bush back in April when everybody thought it was going to be Chief Justice Rehnquist who would retire first. So I think they've been thinking about him for that position for quite a while. But for them to now switch from appointing him to Sandra Day O'Connor's seat now to Rehnquist's seat was quite a coup.
Tony, take us through the thinking that may be behind this. John Roberts has not engendered fierce opposition, though certainly opposition. So is the White House thinking, this is a guy who looks fairly certain to be confirmed, let's put him in the top seat? Is that why he'd be nominated for Chief Justice?
I think that's a good part of the calculus. The other thing is that, in a sense, he might have an easier time replacing Rehnquist than O'Connor. Everybody was the liberal groups were upset that you would have a sharp conservative, John Roberts, replacing a middle a swing vote in O'Connor. But now we have Roberts replacing another very strong conservative. So it's almost a one-for-one replacement, so it doesn't really change. It won't really change the balance of the court for Roberts to replace Rehnquist. So
maybe not, but let me ask you about that. I mean, in a way, these seats are fungible. Anybody with any position could be in any seat. We've also heard speculation that if Roberts goes to one of these seats, the president might nominate a more conservative judge for the second seat, which is now available.
Well, that's certainly possible. I think there's, some thinking that, especially in President Bush's politically weakened state right now, that he might not be cruising for a bruising in another nomination. He might be more conciliatory, but certainly his track record on judicial nominations has been to be confrontational. So you could well be right.
And a different kind of confirmation hearing for John Roberts now that he takes the extra mantle of Chief Justice nomination?
Well, I think it will be. Certainly there are formalities. The Chief Justice is an entirely separate position under statute, so they have to withdraw his nomination as Associate Justice and resubmit it as Chief Justice. And Democrats have already said this morning that the stakes are greater because it is the Chief Justice. He has only one vote, just like the other eight, but there is a sort of symbolism and it will be known through history as the Roberts Court if he becomes Chief Justice. So there is more significance attached to the Chief Justice position.
A new vista opening up right there. We'll be watching. Tony Morrow, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tony Morrow, Supreme Court reporter for the Legal Times. He spoke with me from Alexandria, Virginia. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Job, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Matt Lieber, James Ross, Christina Russo, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Angel Cazelli. Our senior producer is Joe O'Connor. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.